Blog Talk Radio.
Yesterday, August 18th, was the 50th anniversary of the deadly RNA shootout at 1148 Lewis Street in Jackson, Mississippi. Tonight, Mama Tamu Kenyama shares her personal account of that event. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Our roots began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty. Peace family, welcome to Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us weekly radio program that airs every Thursday evening from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Dare to Win is the place where we have sobering conversations about the economic plight of Black people and the imperative that we build the global economic machinery that will free us and once again put us on the path of making history. We at Us Lifting Us have developed an exact methodology on how to build this machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. To join tonight's conversation, please call 929-477-2789. Press the number 1 on your phone when you want to make a comment or ask a question. If you're on your computer, go to www.uslistingus.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, click on the Dare to Win button, then click on Listen Live. You'll be on the Blog Talk Radio website at that time. My name is Q, and joining us for this evening's discussion is Mama Tamu Kenyama, who, like me, is a member of Uru. Peace, Mama Tamu. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm looking forward to tonight's discussion.
Good.
To, be- To begin, Mama Tumu, will you please tell the family about yourself?
About my...
Yourself. Just a little bit.
Okay, sure. I want to... I'm going to go way back. I just want to give you a little background about me. First of all, I was born here in Georgia. My family moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin when I was 2 years old. So I grew up in Milwaukee, and I attended all public schools, for the entire time up through 12th grade, and learned basically nothing about our people, our history, our culture. And I guess I kind of grew up like most Black people at that time, who the move was integration, and that's all I saw. Mm-hmm. However, when I finally entered college, that was a new awakening for me, because we had a Black Studies department, and that was very empowering, because it was fantastic. We learned so much, and also whet our appetites to learn even more. So I began to do a lot more reading about our people, and just wanted to know more and more about our people. And also, while I was in college, I met Baba Hekima. And he introduced me to the Republic of New Africa. And that was another, like, just overwhelming kind of thing for me, because it was new to me. Some of the things that they talked about were new to me, like separation and independence. It had never occurred to me that we could even do that. And So I was just very enamored with everything that they were talking about, because they were talking about, you know, reparations and getting land and just doing for ourselves. So I was just real taken with that. I was in love with that, the concept of that the Republic of New Africa offered. So, but anyway, we worked with that for a while, and and then finally, after meeting everybody, or the people from our RNA, I began to work with them. I worked with Hekima. Hekima was first vice president, and that meant, you know, he would take over. He was next in line to the presidency, so he had certain duties, and I would work with him. And also during that time, many people were still in the community, were still marching and for equal rights and equal housing and jobs and all that kind of stuff. But what they were talking about sounded a lot more like what I wanted to be a part of. So as young adults, we were learning a lot of things, that were exposed about the disparities between our people and the ruling class. So, the more I learned, the more I wanted to learn, and the more I wanted to have our own existence. And this was also during the time of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, but I liked what Martin Luther King, I kind of went more to what he was talking about. I'm sorry, what Malcolm X was talking about. It sounded more like it complemented what we talked about in the Republic of New Africa. So during this time, with J. Edgar Hoover had really started the, you know, really cracking down on anybody that looked like they were trying to do something different than being a part of this system, particularly our people. So anybody that was a part of the Black Liberation Movement were watched and harassed and vamped on. So and this brings us to the RNA in Detroit, Michigan. As a matter of fact, at Aretha Franklin's father's church, they were having a convention there, and there was quite a number of people inside the church, and the police and FBI came and attacked, and they shot, I believe, over 800 rounds into that church, and just indiscriminately shooting, and there was some of the brothers were harmed, but were hurt, but not they did not die, but one policeman did die, and some others were wounded. So of course, you know, this really stirred them up, and they ended up arresting 140 people, but fortunately, Judge Crockett was able to send them all home. He released all of them, except for three, the three people who were accused of the shooting of the police. So then they were exonerated as well in a couple of days. They never had to go to trial. So then, of course, they were really angry now, you know.
Of course.
The Caucasians were really upset, and they started really harassing and just, I mean, and we became, you know, like real targets for them. So they were doing everything because their plans were to just annihilate us and get us on out the way.
Right.
And then in 1971, Hakeem and I were visiting in Mississippi, and in Mississippi we had two government centers, two rental properties that were being used as government centers. So we visited, and we stayed one night. That was fine. The second night we woke up to, I guess you would say, it was like all hell broke loose. We were given a minute and 15 seconds to wake up, and this is a pre-dawn attack. We were given a minute and 15 seconds to wake up, get dressed, and get out of the house. This was the message on the bullhorn. When we were not able to follow those demands, then the house just exploded with bullets and tear gas canisters. It was just a horrific scene with glass breaking, plaster falling. It was just, you know, really just a really horrific scene. Well, it was at that point that, and incidentally there in the house, there were two sisters, myself and another sister, who incidentally was pregnant. And then there were five brothers. So one young brother who was only 17 at that time was able to grab myself and the other sister and took us to safety in a tunnel under the house.
Okay.
Well, when he got us in there, I don't remember what my mind was on at that time, but I thought we were supposed to come out of the house and, you know, keep running. But I was headed toward, I was scrambling from under the house trying to get to the light. And this brother saved my life. He saw me and pulled me by my foot and pulled me back into the tunnel. Because I am so certain that they would have riddled my body with bullets had I made that journey that I was trying to make. Well, anyway, so he got me back in there, and then after a while, the brothers joined us, And, I'm sorry, I guess I skipped the spot because there was an exchange of gunfire.
Okay.
Because we did believe in self-preservation.
Absolutely.
So,
after
a while, and I think it's recorded as saying, you know, the gun battle lasted for 20 minutes. Anyway, but the brothers came on down with where we were, and then finally Hakima saw that they were uniformed police officers, et cetera. And so he told them, you know, let's surrender. And they did. They hollered and told them, just hold their fire, we're coming out. And we did. Mm-hmm. They did let us come on out. And then they had us lay down on the ground for a while in back of the house and, you know, continued to harass and putting his foot on the brothers, asking them questions, interrogating them and everything. Then it took us to the front and had us to sit on the curb. And, of course, we were all handcuffed and, you know, chained, our feet chained and all that. And we sat there, and they continued to just foaming at the mouth, cursing and fussing and nigga this and nigga that, and
right.
threatening our lives and just carrying on. And it was only after we got out that we realized that that there had been a fatal shooting, that one of the policemen had been fatally wounded, and one police and another police and an FBI agent were also wounded. So of course, you know, they're irate, and they call the van, the police van, and had us to you know, get in, and then they tear gassed us the entire way to the to the jail. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And also, at this same time that our house was being attacked, the other government center was being attacked as well by FBI and police. But the difference is that they were already up doing government work. They were dressed and everything, so they were able to follow the directions of the bullhorn that came across on the bullhorn, and. They, you know, just had a conversation. It was nothing happened at that house, but yet they were arrested and charged with the same things that we were charged with. So they were arrested as well. And then in that house, it was one sister and three brothers. So we became known as the RNA 11.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, we were incarcerated in the city jail, and then from the city jail to the county jail. We stayed there for a while, then they took us to Parchman Prison, and then back, we stayed there for a few weeks, and then back to the county jail. And it was at that point that the sister who had been in the house where no shooting took place, she was able to get out. And then about maybe 3 or 4 weeks later, the pregnant sister was able to get out based on her pregnancy because she was in dire need of medical care, prenatal care. So then I was by myself. And I was super happy that we were able to get out, but it was painful to be there by myself. I almost cried. So anyway, as time went on, you know, we had to, you know, there were several black attorneys that immediately after when they heard about the shooting, they had gotten together and came to our defense. So that was such a blessing because they were such great lawyers. I think that we had the best lawyers in the world. Very skillful and you know, kind of knew what they were doing with the situation that it was in that hostile environment. They did really well. So we stayed in Hinds County Jail for the remainder of the time, except for me, and I have no idea, never was explained to me why I was moved, but I was moved to two different jails, but I only stayed in those jails a short while, and then they would bring me right back, and when they would bring me back, my cell was as though I had never left. Everything would stay the same. It was just
right.
reserved for me, apparently. I have to tell you how it was set up. It was set up for the women's side had four cells. The first cell was seemed to have been reserved for Caucasian women. The second cell was used for whatever, but the third cell was for black women, and the fourth cell was for me. And that's you know, kind of the way it was. So anyhow, we would write to each other, et cetera, and we had a lot of support. The incident made international news, so they were not able to or couldn't really kill us like they normally would, you would think, because it was covered by too much news. So that was a real blessing for us, but we fought and of course went to court and the brothers were given life sentences, life without parole. I ended up not going to court. There was a strategy that our president Brother Imari had come up with that helped to exonerate me. So then, once I got out after 10 months, then, you know, I went to work to help free the brothers, all of them, not just my husband, but I worked trying to help everybody to get out.
Right.
And at that point, the brothers, once they were sentenced, they were sent to Parchman Penitentiary, which is a farm. When they got there, well, that it's a very intimidating place. But I visited quite often. I've gone back home to Wisconsin, but I would I'd hop that plane as often as I could and get down to see him. And I'll have to also tell you about Parchman. Like I said, it's very intimidating when you look at it. Is you know, and you see all these people, and some of the guys who were actually prisoners, but they were also serving as guards. So here these prisoners with guns, and you dare not make a move that you to make somebody think you're trying to do something that you weren't supposed to do. Because they would shoot and shoot to kill. So anyway. The one thing I always say that Parchman had, as bad as it was, it still had some very humane certain things about it. And one of the things is the visitation, because you did not have to visit through a glass, see your person through a glass or bars or anything. You actually brought food and things in and sit down and, you know, have dinner with your lunch or with your inmate, and and then they also had conjugal visits, and that was a real plus. And the best visits of all that they had, and you had to earn it, but were 3-day visits, so you could actually go in and live with your person for 3 days, and that was something that I had never heard of. I don't know.
Right.
I still haven't heard of anywhere else that, you know, have that kind of visiting.
Right.
But it was very good for our family because it allowed us to start our family and to have our three daughters. And then once Hakima got home, well, let me back up and say how he got home, because he had life without parole, without the possibility of parole, and 15 years of federal time.
Oh,
which,
okay.
Which turned out to be a real blessing because Parchman was slated for depopulation. They had to depopulate because, you know, it was overcrowded. And
uh-huh.
What they did to depopulate was to send anybody who had other jurisdictions, you know, needed to serve time in some in another jurisdiction. Well, they sent
uh-huh.
them there. So
okay.
they sent our brothers, but then the very next day they realized what they had done. And they like Hakima and one brother came here, another brother
uh-huh.
went somewhere else. But they brought them all back immediately because they
uh-huh.
realized that they were out of order. They could lose
uh-huh.
Jurisdiction over them. And
right.
so they brought them back, and our lawyers went to work. They worked.
Uh-huh.
It took about 3 years for them to get us back in court. But they got us back in court and won. So Mississippi had lost their jurisdiction. And then
uh-huh.
the good thing is that the first, when they won the case, that case, they sent them back to Atlanta, to the federal pen here. And,
okay.
And so all of the time that they had spent starting from the first time that they went, that they sent them to the federal pen and then took them back, well, from
uh-huh.
that day until all those 3 years while we were working on freeing them, all of that time counted as federal time.
Okay, all right.
Because once they crossed that state line like that, they
uh-huh.
Mississippi had lost jurisdiction, so all that time counted
uh-huh.
as federal time, which meant that they had very little time left to serve
right.
in the federal pen.
Uh-huh.
So
uh-huh.
consequently, they were able to come home,
okay.
and that was a real blessing.
So also, how long was that?
Hakima stayed 9 years. All of our brothers, well, not all of them, but the four brothers who had life sentences, it was four of them that had life without parole. Now, three
uh-huh.
of those brothers had federal time. So those three
okay.
were able to get out. But the very
uh-huh.
painful thing and very sad thing for me is that the youngest person who was with us was only 15 years old, and he
Ooh.
Ended up serving more time than anybody.
Uh-huh.
He did not have federal time, so consequently, when they, you know, made that error with the other
uh-huh.
three, he didn't get that benefit because he didn't have that federal time and didn't
no.
have to go anywhere else. So that's very hurtful. When he did finally get out, he was on parole for the rest of his life, and he transitioned a few years ago, about three,
uh-huh.
maybe 3 years ago, something like 3 or 4 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Mama Tamu, what were you all charged with?
We were charged with murder. Trying to overthrow the United States government, treason against Mississippi, handling an automatic weapon. You name it. I can't even remember all the things. We were charged with so much. And
uh-huh.
The thing is it was all set up by J. Edgar Hoover, because
right.
we could when we read some of the paperwork we could see where of course you know they blacked out a lot of it, but
uh-huh.
where J. Edgar Hoover the attorney and the police had sent letters to him saying we can't find anything on these people. You know, these
uh-huh.
people have nothing. And he
uh-huh.
sent back and said, find something. And so
uh-huh.
they did.
Uh-huh.
They
right.
a lot of different charges.
So they just made some stuff up.
Mm-hmm. And when we went to for the federal trial, now I did have to go there. And I forgot that the guy whose name they called him Snoopy, he had joined RNA in Milwaukee, but he was their spy, and I didn't realize. You know, and we of course some people suspected him. I certainly didn't. I thought he was just, you know, kind of awkward.
No.
But anyway, this same guy was keeping the police and FBI informed of everything we did, which they claim that the reason that they attacked our house was that they had warrants for an individual who was not there. The individual that they claimed to have been looking for, they knew his whereabouts and had known his whereabouts for months. They knew when he was in Milwaukee. They knew when he traveled from Milwaukee to Mississippi. They knew when he was at the government center. And I'm sure they knew when he was suspended from the sentence from the center. Because you had to have pretty much impeccable behavior to be staying on that property. And I don't know what he did, but he was, you know, suspended from there. So I'm saying that the informant had all of this. He'd given him all this information. So if they really wanted that guy, they could have arrested him at any time. They could have arrested him on the street by himself, you know, without putting anybody else in harm's way. And they didn't. So my theory is that they thought that Hekima and Brother Imari, the president, would have been at the same place at the same time, and that way they could get rid of both of them and, you know, a few of the rest of us. But, you know, God willing, that did not happen. So that's kind of like what happened with the spy. And even when we went to federal court, they didn't have anything on me, so he created something. He swore that he saw me sitting in a meeting planning to overthrow the United States government.
Right.
So my attorney gave him full opportunity to change his mind, to change his story, you know, by repeating the question. But he was so sure, yes, he saw me. And so she slammed my passport down in front of him and said, if I told you that Tamu Sana, also known as Ann Norman, was studying in Africa at the time that you said she was here at this meeting, you know, anyway, he says he was so shocked. He was like, "Oh, I might have been mistaken." There were several incidents like that. The other incident was when the court, the judge had the whole court to go out on the Gulf. We were in Biloxi, Mississippi, and to prove to the court that we had an automatic weapon. And that we had taken some weapon and made it, or altered it, so to make it fire automatically. Well, we went out there and understand that the ballistic expert, they had that gun in their possession for the whole time. So that means like 2 or 3 years in their possession, and they could have altered it and done anything they wanted. But they didn't think that way. So, but anyway, the guy tried on a number of occasions to fire it and to make it fire automatically and was not able to. And, you know, he finally gave up and said, you know, Your Honor, I can't make this thing fire automatically to save my life. But our brothers were still charged with that and convicted of having an automatic weapon. So that's kind of the way they did things.
Mama Tamu, your attorney, are you able to say the names of your attorney so we could have it on record?
The head attorney was John Britton, and that's Brittan. Mm-hmm. And my attorney was Constance Slaughter Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Fred Banks. I can't think of any of the others' names, but those were the main ones. And, you know, I've spoken to them recently, you know, about my book.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was wondering if you were in touch with any of you and brother, you know, what Baba Hakima were in touch with any of the other men and women that were charged, or the attorneys or anyone else from that time period.
As a matter of fact, we're in contact with the brother that I mentioned earlier, that was 17 at the time. Yeah, we speak with him pretty often, and I guess. And then another sister just told me just a couple of days ago, she's going to get the information for me, how to contact this one brother who went into exile, who was also with us.
Okay.
And then some of the people have transitioned.
Mm-hmm.
At least three of them have transitioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm going to see if there's anyone who would like to join the conversation. To join the conversation, please call 929-477-2789. Press the number 1 on your phone to make a comment or to ask a question. And I'm going to see if there's anybody who wants to.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, there is one.
Reading.
Okay, caller with the last 4 digits, 5663, please state your name, where you're calling from, ask your question, or make your comment. Thank you.
Greetings, everyone. Good evening. This is Mama Labonte out of
Decatur,
Georgia.
Hey.
And just want to say I want to greet Mama Tamu. I'm just coming on, and I'm a fool that you're talking about your book and the experience you had there. I just want to add, I was a part of the Republic of New Africa in California, and when that happened in Mississippi, all of us were affected. Anyone who had a government job lost their job. I was up to... I think I took a test with the post office and got about a 98% and never got called. And some of us were incarcerated. But I think those in California, they're out, and one of them did transition. I think that was Akeem Shagoon. I'm just saying that what happened in Mississippi affected every single chapter in the Republic of New Africa across the country.
Wow.
And, I had FBI came to my father's house and couldn't understand why a student would be involved with a radical group like the Republic of New Africa, and they were looking for me. And they showed them my picture, and my father, naive, he said, "Oh, let me show you a picture of my daughter." Good
picture. Oh, wow.
But we were a little naive in that we did not understand that we did not have to talk to anybody come to our house unless they had a woman. And it was a huge learning experience for all of us that was involved. And there were other situations that took place in California where, we the foreign pole came into us, and people were agents in the group, and they they disappeared after it was found out who they were. We never saw them again. And then I know about the folks that went on exile, and I think they went to Cuba, and I think both of them are deceased at this time, as far as I know, those that went to Cuba. So I just wanted to add that into the conversation.
You know that the one of the brothers that I mentioned, that Mama Kali just told me about, that who we haven't heard from him since way back, because he went into exile. Now he went to Africa. You know, the last we heard, this one went to Africa. I'm certainly hoping that we will be able to contact him.
Right. And sorry, I wasn't able to make it last night, but somebody in the house came up with COVID positive. So we were unable to go anywhere except to go get a test, you know. So I regret not being able to celebrate you there, but I do have a book. And you did autograph it.
Good.
All right.
Thank you,
everybody. Thank you.
Take care. Mm-hmm. You too. Mama Tamu, when you mentioned that the message came from J. Edgar Hoover to find something or make something up, it reminds me of someone that I knew in the Black Panther Party, that they couldn't find anything on her. And this is part of the New York, I forget what their number is, but it was a bunch of them. And they charged her with having a knife in her kitchen.
Charged her with what?
Having a knife in her kitchen. Because there was nothing else they could find on her.
Wow.
So that when you said makeup stuff,
they will make up stuff,
and they were not very creative, you know. And she said that the judge was going to let her go, and the and he got a call at the court, and he said, just a minute, let me just, and I'll come answer the phone. And they were like, no, you have to go to the phone now. And then when he went to the phone, he came back and charged her with the craziness. But it was because, I guess, J. Edgar Hoover, not him necessarily personally, but the word came down, she is to be held. And we have another caller on the line, Mama Tamu, so I'm going to take that call. Caller with the last 4 digits, 3440, please state your name, where you're calling from, ask your question, or make your comment. Thank you.
Yes, greetings and good evening, Mama Tamu and Sister Q. This is Brother Shabaka, and currently I'm calling from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm really enjoying the program today, and I'll be brief. I just wanted to ask you, from your experience, what motivated you, I guess, to, you know, put this to paper? If you could, you know, tell us, you know, your thoughts and, you know, over the years, and then what finally got you to say, well, I gotta write this down. And I'll just hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you so much. It's very informative, you know.
Okay, and thank you for calling
in.
The thing that made me write is when this whole thing happened, I had said then that someday I would write about it. I didn't know it would take me 50 years. as a matter of fact, that's how I named the book. That's why the title is 1148 Lewis Street. One of the parents of one of our comrades, I guess it was a group of us talking. I don't even remember who all was there, but I said, that's when I said, someday I'm going to write about this. And she says, you should, you should title your book 1148 Lewis Street. And I never forgot that. I never forgot that. So I always knew that if life lasts, that I would write and that the book would be entitled 1148 Lewis Street.
Okay.
So,
that's awesome. Mama Timu, I have a question. How did what you were doing with the NRA, how did that lead to Ulu?
How did it lead to Ulu?
To Ulu.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, basically, we have always done community work. We've pretty much, I don't think we ever said verbally that I dedicate my life to this, but it just happened that, you know, we just kind of dedicated our lives to doing things to uplift our people. And while Hakima was incarcerated, he came up with a blueprint for functional unity. That was the African Community Centers for Unity and Self-Determination. So he tried a couple times to put it out there, and it didn't take hold. And finally, after we had moved to Georgia here in 2003, he pulled the family together and said, we're going to do this. And we did, and it took off. And we had much success with the African Community Centers. And at this particular time, it has taken a nosedive, but is not dead. So we're still working with it. My daughter and, my middle daughter and I pretty much work with it. But during the time when ACC was really happening, a lot of programs were birthed from it. And one of the things that was birthed was our 10-10-50 program, where we try and encourage people to support black businesses and black organizations. And we say the first 10, we say that find an organization or a business that you think is doing positive things for our people, you know, a business that you or organization that you respect, and donate 10 hours of your time to that organization. And then the second 10 is that usually the organization is going to need money, and so donate $10 a month to that organization. The 50, we ask that you redirect $50 that you're already spending outside of our community and spend it inside of our community. So that was just one program. So there were many others, and I don't know if I have time to even talk about all of them. But Ulu was birthed out of the African Community Centers as well. And once something is birthed out of the center, it doesn't mean that, you know, we're an overseer or anything, or trying to be, you know, a mother organization of it. It takes on, many of them take on a life of their own, and that's what has happened with Ulu. It came from us, but it stands on its own.
Okay, awesome. That is, your whole story is really mind-boggling. But like the sister that called it said, this kind of stuff is going on all over the country at the same time. And a lot of people were impacted. And very few took the time to write about it and, you know, basically tell our side of the story.
Right.
You know, it's like all that the community gets to hear is what is in the newspaper or what's, you know, what's on the news if they decide to do a, you know, like yesterday was the 50th anniversary of the shooting there. So if they were going to do it on the news, they were slanted in a way to make y'all look like y'all were wrong.
I'm glad that you wrote it down
and that you're sharing and talking to us about what happened there. We're getting close to out of time for this program, but Mama Timur, I would like you to tell us what it is you would like to make sure the family takes away from what you told us tonight?
To be consistent with doing things that you feel are positive, doing things to get us out of this clutch that we're in. So, but to be consistent no matter what. You know, we've been a lot of years, but we find ways to do things that we think are positive and that are helpful. So that's about it, is to find it and be consistent with it.
Okay. We have someone else on the line, so I'm going to bring them on. Take their question or comment before we go.
Okay.
Caller with mask 4 digits 7178. Please state your name, where you're calling from, and make your comment or ask your question. Thank you.
Greetings, Sister Q and Mama Tamu. This is Brother Chago Wilson calling from Detroit, Michigan. And I just wanted to emphasize to all the listeners that the book 1148 Lewis Street is available for purchase at uslifting.us.com. Then click on the store key. And you purchase a fascinating book, and it's a worthwhile read. Please get it now.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. So anything else you'd like to share, Mama Tamu, in the last couple of minutes?
To say that, it's important for us to tell our story, and write our own history and not wait for other people to do it.
Yes, that's a very good point. Because, I don't know, and in a way we seem to think that we have to go to others to either have them write it for us or give us permission to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things in this time and space is that we don't have to do that. You can tell a story the way you want to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very important what you did, and I'm glad that I had the time to talk with you tonight about 1148 Lewis Street. All right. So if you have, I think we're going to, let's see if there's anybody else on the line. There is not. So then what I will do is just play a song to take us out.
Okay.
And thank you very much for spending time with us this evening, for sharing your story and telling about your book. And I would also like to thank everyone who joined us. And I would like to remind everybody, join us again this Thursday evening at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. We will have another installment of Dare to Win at that time. With that, I would say peace. Thank you, Mama.
Yeah. All right. And thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay.